morning, friends. Good to see you. I have a little bit of a frog in my throat, so if he jumps out, don't be startled. I have some things I want to talk about before we get to today's message. Last week, I think early in the week, many of you received an email from me asking you to pray for a young man named David Emerson. If you received this email, it's just because in the moment, I was thinking, who do I know will pray? And so I sent you the email. If you didn't and you want to be someone that I would send an email like this to, let me know. So last Monday night, John Greeter, who's Carrie Kaufman, is Carrie downstairs? Yeah. Her dad, he's absolutely one of my lifetime best friends. He had contacted me over the weekend and said that this fellow, who's a friend of both of us, David Emerson, but had been John's friend since junior high, was dying. And I knew that. He is a brittle alcoholic. And he has just had so much alcohol over the years that he's just has no liver left. And so we went to see him at a nursing home over here. And so you always wonder when you're going to see an old friend who you know is ill, what are you going to see when you walk in the room? That's just kind of what I'm thinking. What's it going to be like when I walk in the room? So we came in, he's bedridden, and thin as can be, and yet he had a very receptive attitude. He was so happy to see us. And he knew why we were coming. We were coming to talk to him about his immortal soul. And he knew that. He knew that we were coming to talk to him about, if you died tonight, do you know where you will spend eternity? He knew that. And he knew that we were going to present him with the Jesus story and the Jesus power that he might, if he would get to this, that he might receive this for himself and be, the word I kept saying to John in preparation was assurance. We want to leave that room and he is to have full assurance if he trusts Jesus that he is going to heaven. So we go and he's doing what he does best, which was watch basketball on TV. He's amazing. If you say, hey, who won the NCAA in 1993? He'll tell you. He's a really sharp guy about those things. And so then we began this talk. And so I asked him, I said, Dave, what does the cross mean to you? And he was very careful. And he wasn't just giving the pat answer kind of thing. Because I said, I don't want any pat answers. I want to know what it means to you. And so we work through, what does the resurrection mean for you? What does knowing that you're going to heaven, what could that mean for you? Well, it was a remarkable time. It was really good. And so then John, I think, said, David, do you feel like praying? And he said, I do. And so he prayed. And he prayed beautifully and simply but profoundly. Lord Jesus, forgive me for my many sins. I have to have you. Take me to be with you. It was very wonderful. Now, while he was praying, I had my hand on his shoulder. I was sitting right by the bed, and I had my hand on his shoulder. And so I'm going along with his prayer. And then the thought comes to me to pray for him, for his healing, because the thought was just too hard that he would die soon. So I just had this feeling, and I just prayed, Lord, if it would be according to your best for David, extend his life. Not that he would die soon, but that he would have an extended life. And that was about all there was to it. I ask you to pray the same thing. And I know another prayer group out by Congerville was praying the same thing. This morning I got an email. The doctor came into David on Friday and basically said, I don't know what's happened, but your liver has started working again. And instead of a couple of months, you probably have a few years to live. Now, he is desperately ill, and he can never take a drink again. He has very little liver, and what he has needs to function, and it needs to work. And he really doesn't have a place to live other than the nursing home. He's bedridden. But our prayer for him is that fellowship will become a part of his life, and that was something we talked about after he prayed. And I said to him, David, now tomorrow there are going to be nurses come into your room. Do you have the courage to say to the nurse, I trusted Jesus last night? Because when we say those things with our mouth, something happens in our soul. It kind of embeds it in us. If we have the courage to say to somebody, I trusted Jesus, something good happens. And I think he really is a new person. I mean, he is. He's a new person. And so we'll see what coming times bring, but I'll tell you, I read that, and I saw David Emerson on that subject thing, and I thought, well, what happened? What happened was God answered these prayers. So if you prayed, thank you. Wouldn't it be great if David came someday? I would hope that he would. Wouldn't it be great if he became a part of our fellowship? It really would. So continue to pray for him. One of the things I told him is, now that you've done this, expect the enemy to be more in your life than you've ever understood. You're going to have doubts. You're going to have naysayers. You're going to have all kinds of things. You have to take the words of Jesus and say, Lord, I believe, help my unbelief. You have to ask God to take what you have in faith and multiply it. And so that's where we are with David now, and I thank all of you. Okay, the second thing, Micah, could you put that up, please? Yeah, I don't know how well you can read that, but we're going to go through it a little bit. So our oldest daughter lives in Germany, and she has been involved in a ministry to refugees from the Middle East. And if you follow the news at all, you know that Germany, more than any other country, has kind of opened their doors, and they have hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of refugees. They also have an enormous problem. But she's ministering to these people and has found great meaning in that. She said at church, the head of GEM, and this thing here is sponsored by GEM, which is Greater Europe Missions. The head of GEM goes to their church. It's headquartered in this little town in Germany for all of Europe. And that mission has asked for the word to be spread in the United States amongst college students, amongst people who have some freedom with time, but more than anything, amongst people who feel drawn to this ministry. And in order to explain this to us, she told us the story of a young man who was at church last week, I think, wasn't it, Sue? A young Libyan man in his 20s, and he was brought to church, and his story was told. He had been arrested several times in Libya, because it depends on which side of the mayhem over there you find yourself on. Because it's mayhem. Libya is a nightmare. We don't hear much about it. It's a nightmare of nobody in charge. And so time and time again, he would be put in jail. He would be kicked out of jail. He'd be put in jail, kicked out of jail. He finally decides, I got to get out of here. He gets on a boat on the Mediterranean. The boat goes out. The Libyan Navy catches the boat. They bring everybody back. They put him in jail.
Right. And so he just worked for this company.
Yeah, but because of that.
Because he worked for that company, he was dead. I mean, they wanted to kill him.
Yeah, you know? Did you hear that? He worked for a company, and the boss of the company was on the wrong side of the political aisle. And so they wanted to kill all of his employees or imprison them or whatever. So he tried 4 times to escape from Libya. And the 4th time, he got away. But friends, these people that get away, and it's happening right now, there are people in boats, and there have been thousands who have died. Right now, there are people trying to escape Syria, Libya, who knows what all over there. You can't escape from some of these places. But there are Christians on the shore of Greece. Now, if you get Christianity Today, the cover story, I just got mine yesterday or the day before, the cover story is about this effort to receive these refugees. And the truth is, I know of 2 groups who are receiving these refugees. One, amazingly, is an organization of Israeli doctors. And so these Muslims who are trying to escape for their lives sometimes float into shore because they've run out of gas, you know, whatever, and they are helped off their boats by Jews. They're mortal enemies. And I've seen this. I've seen it on the 700 Club. They're very happy to be welcomed off their boat. They hug these people. And immediately they're given a physical. They're given medicine, food, water, all these things by the people they would view as their mortal enemies. And they soon realize these aren't my mortal enemies. It's very powerful. But most of this work is being done by Christians. I have never seen a story where Muslim groups are meeting these Muslims. I just don't see that that's happening. But Christians are. And so Greater Europe Missions wants to organize Americans who have freedom to come over. And Kristen said in a note this morning, they're looking for from 2 weeks to 2 months. And so in that period of time, you'd receive some quick training, and then you'd go live along the coast of Greece in a place where it's secure and you're getting your meals and all that kind of stuff. But what would you do? You'd wait on that seashore, and you'd embrace families, young and old, sick and well, all scared, all trying to save their lives. And so Kristen said, would you promote this? And I absolutely would. And I would ask any of you who think, hey, I have a couple weeks. All I have to do is get there. Really, it's all you have to do is get there and get back. Okay? So here it is. The location is Lesvos, Greece. It's going on right now through the summer. It's going to cost $750 and airfare. 4 to 5 people, you know, we could form a team. If God moves you in this, come and see me. If the church formed a team, then we would raise money. This is this is such a time of turmoil in the world that we don't do anything but read about or hear about. But friends, Europe is in a quandary right now. And this day could come to America, too. I'm not going to even speak about that. But this is a call to Christians to respond to an absolute need. And I know this. If I did this, I would be forever different. If you did this, you'd be forever different. So think about it. Pray about it. Okay? All right. Thank you, Micah. So, working on this sermon is one of the hardest weeks of study and preparation I've ever done. Sometimes it's like falling off a log. You know, if it's a passage of scripture that's very clearly understood and just needs to be fleshed out and so on. I just love that. Embrace it. It's not hard. This is hard. This is really hard because I had all these commentaries. I had all my notes from grad school, which I've poured over time and time again. And in studying these, I was reading ancient church fathers. What are these verses telling us? What is the essence of this? And I have landed in a spot that I'm not immovable from, but I needed to land somewhere. So that's where I am in this. Maybe some of you have studied Romans 9 through 11. If you haven't, get ready, because we're going to study it. I want to start Romans 9 with Malachi 1. Malachi is the last book in the Old Testament. So turn to Matthew and turn back to your left. What is so hard about this Romans 9 through 11? Friends, what does John tell us God is? God is love. What have you always thought about the nature and character of God? God is love. That whatever love you've experienced because he first loved you. Scriptures teach us that. And so our correct understanding of who God is that God is the very author and perfecter of love. But wait a minute. It says here that he hated Esau. What? What do I do with that? Let's start. Malachi 1. The oracle of the word of the Lord to Israel by Malachi. I have loved you, says the Lord. But you say, how have you loved us? Is not Esau Jacob's brother? Declares the Lord. Yet I have loved Jacob, but Esau I have hated. I have laid waste his hill country and left his heritage to jackals of the desert. If Edom, now this is important, Edom is another term for Esau's descendants. And you'll see Edom in the Old Testament books as a race of people, the Edomites. And so that's who we're talking about here. If Edom says, we are shattered, but we will rebuild the ruins, the Lord of hosts says, they may build, but I will tear down. And they will be called the wicked country. And the people with whom the Lord is angry forever. What? The people with whom the Lord is angry forever. Your own eyes shall see this, and you shall say, great is the Lord beyond the border of Israel. Okay, I just want you to take that passage in a little bit. I want you to let that passage work around inside you a little bit. And what does it tell you about the character of God? Because I will say this, it seems to be contrary to what we know about God. That it seems to put out there a kind of dedicated vindictiveness of the God of the universe that he would look at a people group and say, I have nothing but destruction in mind for you. All right, let's turn to Romans 9. Now remember last week we established that there is a group of people that the Bible calls Israel, and that group of people are comprised of two types, those who are true Israel and those who are not. And what is the distinction? What is the difference? The distinction, the difference is belief. True Israel believes. The Israel which is not really Israel does not believe. Now here's an interesting thing as a starting point. We said it last week, I'm going to say it again. With whom does all this talk of belief begin? Abraham. Abraham is the first character in the Bible who is singled out, lifted up, and appreciated, not because of what he's done. He's done rotten things. But because of his belief. Abraham believed God, and that believing was counted to him as righteousness. Okay? So, we established that last week. We reestablished it here. Now, let's pick up with verse 8. This means that it is not the children of the flesh who are the children of God, but the children of the promise are counted as offspring. For this is what the promise said. About this time next year, I will return and Sarah will have a son. She hears that, she laughs. She names the son, he laughs. Isaac means he laughs. And not only so, but also when Rebekah had conceived children by one man, this is important. So Sarah conceives a child, but so does Hagar, who is Abraham's helper, maid. Actually, Sarah's maid. And Sarah says, hey, you need to have a baby. And then she gets mad. It's a mess. But not so with Jacob and Esau. With Jacob and Esau, we have one husband. We have one lover. We have monogamy. Now, in this monogamous relationship, we have twins born. Two boys. Let's keep going here because this is important. Had conceived children by one man, our forefather Isaac, though they were not yet born and had done nothing either good or bad. In order that God's purpose of election, as Scott mentioned, God's purpose of election. What in the world is that? Friends, that's more than we'll ever understand. And I've come to believe that if you're here today and you're loving Jesus, it's just the absolute truth that you're here and you're loving Jesus because he loved you. And as he says, no one can come to the Father unless the Father draws him. That our coming to Christ happens because in the immeasurable mystery of all of this, God has singled us out as individuals and said, I choose you. Jesus says to his disciples, you didn't choose me. I chose you. Jesus says of this election thing, my Father is the great shepherd, and no one will snatch his sheep out of his hand. You're secure in the Father's hand. This becomes one of Christendom's ongoing feuds. And in graduate school, I'm in class with a bunch of people who embrace that, and I would say 90% of my professors embrace that, but you didn't have to embrace that. And there would be other people who said, I don't think it's that way at all. I don't think it's that way at all. And so then they would present that, and it's like, yeah, that's good. Oh, no, that, yeah, that's good. You know, and so you find yourself kind of in the middle of all this. One of the things that was said, now this isn't what you establish anything on. But it was said in a discussion that if you just want to do this mathematically, there are twice as many verses that support the Reformed view than there are which support the Arminian view. Okay, well, that's a number. But the fact is, this is a cloudy, cloudy area. I have to look at it and say, now, what did Jesus say? Not what did this commentary say, because that commentary can tie me in knots. What did Jesus say? And Jesus says, you didn't choose me. I chose you. You can't be snatched out of my Father's hand. He has made you his sheep. He is the great shepherd. I am the great shepherd. I am the gate for the sheep. All these things over and over. And so right here, we have Paul talking about God's purpose of election might continue, not because of works, but because of his call. Now, this is an important verse, friends. And I think this is one of the verses that moves me the most. That the purpose of election is not predicated on anything you would ever do. Because according to the Bible, the best things I would do compared to God are called what? Filthy rags. The best I could do. Those things are filthy rags compared to the perfection and righteousness of God. And so what we have, and Scott shared that passage from Ephesians, which is remarkable, what we have is that any sense that we are righteous, and we should have that sense, is not by works of righteousness which we have done, but by his mercy he saves us. He imputes the very perfection of Jesus onto the people he has chosen. This is heavy duty, friends. This is heavy duty stuff. But it's not because of works. It comes up short. Now, there is in Christianity, there are entire denominations of believers. I think they're believers as much as I'm a believer. But they would say, no, you got to throw works in there. And why do they say this? They say, because faith without works is dead. Where'd they get that? They got it from the Bible. They got it from the book of James. It's true. But I think that it becomes the confirmation of someone's election, not the cause of it. It isn't because you went to Greece that you're saved, but because you were saved and called, you went to Greece. Okay? Let's keep going here. She was told, the older will serve the younger. Do you realize how revolutionary that phrase is? That you have an entire nation predicated on some things. And one of those things is the firstborn son gets the benefit. And the rest of the kids serve the firstborn son. And what in the world just happened here? God flips that over and says, that isn't how it's going to work. The second one is the one that I have chosen. And I think that's intentional, because he's showing this salvation business cannot be put together by people, because it's contrary to what people would do. So here we have this guy Jacob, and he's really worth learning about. That we're called Jacob as well is awesome, because I use the word rascal, capitalize the R. He was a rascal. His very name is the name of a rascal. And he does rotten things to his brother Esau over and over again. He treats Esau terribly. But Esau is fool enough to go for it. So, hey, you're hungry and thirsty? I'll give you some of my soup here if you give me your birthright. Sure. You know, come on. God had chosen Jacob, it said a couple verses ago, before he was born. And then we have Paul in Ephesians saying that before the foundation of the world, before the world was made, he had chosen you. And this is kind of where I got wiggly and kind of squirrely in studying this when I was in grad school. When I started to consider, and I want you to consider this, is my affection for the gospel, my embracing of the gospel, is my being what I would identify myself as, a Christ follower, is all of this something that was determined before the world was made? You want to melt? That it has nothing to do with me? Nothing to do with me. This is a consideration. I ask you to consider this. I'm not trying to spoon feed you anything, because this is an ongoing discussion. One of the great theological minds of the 20th century, see, Chris can't stand it anymore. She's got to leave. Enough of you, she says. I'm going down the street. One of the great theologians of the 20th century was A.W. Tozer. Raise your hand if you've heard of A.W. Tozer. Yeah, good, good, I'm glad. A great mind. He dealt with this issue. And so I'm not the first. Spurgeon dealt with this issue. Spurgeon moved from one side to the other. A.W. Tozer said something, and I believe this, and I've said it before here, but years ago. A.W. Tozer said that, and this is metaphorical, but it's brilliant, that when we, so I'm looking at, and Brother Bruce is welcoming me into heaven, and that's the gate of heaven right there. And that sign doesn't say exit, but on this side, it says, whosoever will may come. Well, what does that sound like to you? Whosoever will may come. It's wide open to everybody, isn't it? And in a way, it is. But when you get on the other side of that door and you turn around, it will say, chosen before the foundation of the world. So what we have to do, and all I can come up with is the headiest, heaviest, most significant things about salvation are not able to be understood. I can't understand the Trinity. If you can, let's have coffee and you explain it to me. But I can embrace it. I can say it is intentionally beyond my ability to explain, because I am weak. And when I am weak, what is he? Strong. And so we have all these issues that, I mean, sometimes, friends, they'll be the sweetest young person killed in a wreck. And we're like, why? What is going on? God, where are you? Sometimes an old, bitter, nasty person will be blessed with wealth and power and all. It's like, what is going on? Listen, friends, David wrote about that very thing in the Psalms and says, what's happening here, Lord? Why are the wicked prospering and the righteous are suffering? This is not new. This is not a new thing. Somehow, in the brokenness of these shadowlands we live in now, there are unexplainable realities. Harvey is real good at sharing things with me, and he shared a book with me that I had to read in 2 weeks because I got it free on the Kindle for 2 weeks. It was a long book. So I started it about 3 days into my 2 weeks. It was like, whoa, it says I'm 6% done and I've been reading for hours kind of thing. I'm serious. So I had to read that puppy every day and night. It's called The Flower of God. And now here, this is difficult. And I told Sue, this is so difficult for me. Somehow I want you to know about this and deal with this. The Flower of God is the story of this man looking back on his ancestors and how did he get to where he is today, and his cousins and his siblings. I mean, how did they get here, or Australia, which is another place? And they're the children of Israel. Friends, this guy goes back 2,800 years. And he finds out about his ancestors because they have a last name, Ozabel, that means one who takes care of the spices for the temple. He was able to find people with that name and what happened to them, and that they were relatives. Now, here's my point. I don't want to get too lost in this, but here's my point. If you read this book, you're going to find two things happening in your family. Men or being tortured or being run out of town. They're living in Siberia. They're living in China. They're living in Poland. While it's Poland, then it's Germany, then it's Russia. They're living in the woods. They've lost everything. Yet someone in that remnant is talking about God. And there is a sense of we are still God's people. Now, this is where I struggle. Harvey, I would love to read that this man became a Messianic Jew, that he embraced Jesus, because that would be kind of a capstone on their story. But do not think that because the Jews, and this family is just quintessential Jewish, that because they have died by the millions in torturous ways, that they are no longer God's people. Because there's always a remnant which escapes. I don't know why. I don't know why the Nazis said, what we're going to do is we're going to eliminate Jews from the world. I don't know why. Does that make any sense to you? But that's what they set out to do. I do believe this, and I think Mr. Ozabel believes this, that all of these centuries, even millennia of suffering, forced a stiff-necked people, the Jews, to do something. It forced them to go back to their native land. And his family was a part of the founding of Israel. And so I think that's critically important, that we can look and see now and say for nearly 2,000 years, they were wandering. You know, there's a plant called a wandering Jew. They were wanderers. But now, in miracle of miracles, they become a nation. And they are that nation that is threatened on every side. It's mysterious. It's magnificent. I don't get it. But Jacob I have loved. And in Malachi it says, I've done these things for you, and you've turned your back on me. Somehow God, and we're going to get to this in succeeding chapters, God is still going to save Israel. And I'm not yet sure exactly what that means. But I do think there's going to be a revival in the Jew that's like nothing we've ever seen before, but I think it's at the height of despair that this will happen. So we shall see. Now, our last point for today is, what does this mean that Jacob I have loved and Esau I have hated? This discussion of hate sent me diving. What in the world? God hating. I guess if you'd have said to me, what does God hate? I would say God hates sin. Because I can kind of say, okay, yeah, he should, you know. But it's more than that. Let's read this together. Mr. Murray's a smart guy. I don't know much about him. He talks kind of funny. Probably British. I don't know. Bruce, can you hit the front lights? Because I'm having trouble. Thanks. We do not predicate of this divine hate. Did you talk like that? Oh, dear. We do not predicate dinner tonight based upon... Blah, blah, blah. No. We do not predicate of this divine hate those unworthy features belong to hate as it is exercised by us sinful men. So what he's just said here is, when it says, Esau I have hated, don't think about that in human terms. That's helpful. It's like to me, it's like, whoa. It takes a little of the pressure off. Now, how do I think about this, however? Yellow type. In God, there is no malice. Malignancy. Vindictiveness. Unholy rancor. Or bitterness. It's hard for me to think about hate without those qualities. I think so much in terms of military history, sorry. And I know in my own family that there were 8 boys who were Berries, and 3 of them fought for the South and 5 of them fought for the North. They were brothers. That's the way that war was, friends. And my great-grandfather fought for the South. Very rough. And it causes a malignancy of attitude. And he's saying, God's hate does not have that. The hate thus characterized is condemned in Scripture. And it would blaspheme to predicate the same of God. So he tells us that. However, I never found a definition of God's hate. I just found out what it is not. And that's somewhat helpful. One more slide. This is the whole issue of Esau I have hated that I think we have to come down to with this. And so we're going to stop at this point today. When God determines who shall and who shall not enjoy his blessings, be they earthly or heavenly, he does so according to what? According to his sovereign good pleasure, and not according to anything in men. I've just opened a can of worms that we're going to pick through the next few weeks. Because if you're like me, you're saying, so this means that blessing, salvation, the kindnesses of God, the favor of God is for Kyle. But it may not be for Kyle's cousin. And Kyle has nothing to do with that. I remember in grad school, Dr. Sam Storms telling the story of twins. And it wasn't in the context of Jacob and Esau, but listen to this story. There were twin brothers. One's name was Eddie, I remember. But he told this long story about how these twins had grown up, identical twins, had grown up the same of everything, the same of everything. And in their 20s, one of them becomes a Christian. The other does not. And in their 30s, the other is killed in a car wreck with no evidence that he ever came to Christ, while Eddie is walking with God. Now, this theology that I talked about today would say that Eddie is walking with God because God declared that Eddie would walk with him. But the other brother is not because God declared that he wouldn't. Oh, can of worms. Can of worms. We'll have to talk some more about it. It's a good outcome. It's just tough. Okay? So that means you'll have to be here next week. And now let's sing.